and welcome everyone to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is WebSphere Application Server Top 5 Performance Topics. Today's presenter is Travis Holzhauer. Travis serves as a subject matter expert on performance issues within the WebSphere Application Server Level 2 Support Organization. His team acts as a triage and entry point for all things performance related within the realm of WebSphere Application Server. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Travis.
Thank you, David. This is Travis, and we can go ahead and get started. We're going to move on to slide 2, which has a brief agenda for what we're going to be looking at today. It's a pretty straightforward agenda. We'll go over some introduction material to the presentation, an overview of the top 5 performance topics, and then a breakdown of them. And we'll finish up with a summary and some questions and answers as well. Moving on to slide 3, which is the introduction. Again, my name is Travis Holzhauer. I do work in the WebSphere Application Server Level 2 support organization, specifically on what we call the WAS SDK team, which is the entry point for all performance-related issues, and we triage every performance-related issue that comes in with regard to WebSphere Application Server. And that, that can include stack products that are built on top of WebSphere Application Server as well. Moving on to slide 4, as we look at some of the introduction to the presentation itself, the idea today is to provide some feedback, really, to customers, to other support representatives, to anyone who's here today as to the top performance issues that we see in Level 2 support. And so this presentation was created by actually polling the people on the team, on my team, and compiling that list down and filtering things out and then finding, you know, the things that we spend, you know, the most time working on. And so the idea here is that if you're aware of the issues, you can possibly avoid them altogether, or at least we can expedite resolution by you being familiar with the topics and the components and things involved. So these really are the issues we encounter most. Moving on to slide 5, which is going to show a quick overview of the 5 performance topics. They're in no particular order, although they may be in the order of increasing complexity. We could say that the first couple are rather straightforward and simple, but that's not to say that they don't resolve just as many problems, and simple solutions are much better than complex ones. So we didn't want to exclude them just because they were simple, because they still resolve a number of issues as well. So with that, we'll jump to slide 6, which shows that we're going to dive down into the first topic, which we've entitled maintenance. Slide 6, now that we're going into that, we'll move to slide 7, which breaks down the maintenance topic. Okay, so a number of the performance issues that we actually encounter are resolved by applying fixes that already were available at the time that the PMR was opened. That is to say that we didn't actually have to rediscover, or we didn't have to, you know, discover a problem and determine the solution. We simply had to rediscover it. So if we're up to date on our maintenance, these issues wouldn't exist at all. And you could avoid these issues altogether. So there's an example of a situation where you could simply avoid encountering the problem at all. So the most critical maintenance, the most critical maintenance that we're talking about here relates to WebSphere Application Server fixed pack levels, the Java SDK, or if you're on Solaris, the Sun, or HP, or Oracle, JDK maintenance levels. And then the operating system patches and Windows updates and things like that come into play as well. Those resolve a number of the problems because they've already been, you know, we've already encountered the problem, we've already resolved it, and the only thing that's left is for you to apply the maintenance to receive the fix for that issue. Moving on to slide 8, we also see that there are some others as well. Database drivers, third-party software, monitoring tools that you may be using, those are common when those end up being back level or out of sync with maybe some other upgrades that you've done. So you upgraded your WebSphere Application Server fixed pack level but not your third-party monitoring solution, and there may have been some dependency there. And we can see performance issues, among other issues, arise from inconsistencies like that. I do want to point out that prior to version 8 of WebSphere Application Server, the quote-unquote app server maintenance, and the Java SDK maintenance are independent of one another. So you can upgrade your WebSphere application server fixed pack level without upgrading your Java SDK, or vice versa. So that can be, that can be desirable in some situations where you don't want to make too many changes. After version 8, however, those are bundled together. And I did provide a link, if you're looking at the PDF or if you want to revisit the slide later, to the recommended fixes page for WebSphere Application Server. And so from there, you can find all the latest maintenance for WebSphere Application Server and the Java SDK that it runs on that site. As far as your operating system and database drivers and third-party software, you need to visit the vendor's website for that, of course. Moving on to slide 9. So this takes us back up to our 5 topics. So again, as I mentioned, the first couple are pretty straightforward and simple here, but they're not to be excluded simply because of that. So we'll move on to the tuning subject. So then we're going to move on to slide 10. So there's a number of different performance issues that we see come up related to tuning, and there's a couple of different subcategories under that. One example where we see performance issues arise is when we're using some sort of migrated tuning. So we were on a previous version of WebSphere Application Server, and then we migrated to another. It doesn't actually matter if you went through the official migration. If you just moved, we'll see customers or users that can, they just take their tuning parameters that they had in one version of the product, and they simply, lay those down in the new version of the product. But there's a lot of differences between, the different versions, especially, to point out here, a couple moving from one version of the Java SDK to another. The 1.4.2 SDK is drastically different from the 1.5 and the 1.6 versions of the SDK. We see when you're moving from different bit levels, so your previous version was 32-bit, now you've moved to 64-bit, but you didn't change anything. You left your 32-bit configuration in place for the 64-bit environment, and that's not gonna lead to optimal performance at all. Cross-platform migrations is just something to keep in mind. If you were on, say, Solaris previously, and now you've moved to Linux or AIX or something like that, the same parameters may not even function in the new environment, and they may have different effects as well. So it's important to keep that in mind. And then the scaling considerations. In your previous environment, you may have had so many servers, and now you have twice as many servers, and you didn't make any changes for that or account for any of that. So it's just important that whenever you're doing any tuning, and if you're moving from one version to another version of anything, whether it's bit level or WebSphere version or platform or the number of JVMs, all those things need to be taken into account, and the previous tuning won't be the same tuning as it is for the new environment. Each environment needs to be tuned in and of itself. Another one that we see towards the bottom of the slide is the default heat settings in production. There's a number of PMRs, cases that are opened up with support for performance issues, and we've come to find out that they're using the default heap settings. The default heap settings, this is the Java heap that we're referring to, is seldom sufficient to facilitate productive work. The default heap settings are just that. They're there to be out of the box, and they will need to be tuned in almost all cases. And usually when this happens is when there's no real-world testing was performed, leading up to going into production. Move on to slide 11. Some more tuning considerations. Garbage collection tuning, specifically. The optimal performance can vary from an application to another application with regard to garbage collection, and what is optimal can be different depending on who's looking at the problem, which admin is looking at it. And we also need to keep in mind things like the fact that it takes some time for the JVM to warm up, for garbage collection to warm up, for the just-in-time compiler to warm up, for JSTs to be compiled. So if you're doing some testing and maybe comparing different configurations and tuning, it's important to remember that if you're doing a short test, you may get one kind of result, but when you actually go to run that JVM for days or weeks or months, you might get a different result. Because of that warm-up period. So you just need to keep that in mind as you go through whatever garbage collection tuning you might be doing. And at the bottom of this slide, again, we're still on slide 11, I've included a link to the WebSphere Application Server Performance Team, and they publish a number of different white papers and other documents that you might find helpful while doing whatever tuning you're doing, whether it's garbage collection or heap tuning or any other kind of tuning within the WebSphere Application Server. environment. We will move on to slide 12. Okay, so coming back up to the high level here, looking at our five topics, we're now going to step into the coding topic. This is much more complicated. The next two are much more complicated than the previous two. So we'll move on to slide 13. There's a couple different subtopics within this coding topic, and the first one we're going to, and some of them are related, but the first one that we're going to look at is unmanaged threads. And before knowing what a unmanaged thread is, it might be simpler to explain what a managed thread is. A managed thread is well-named and originates from the WebSphere.run method. If we look at the thread stack that's off to the right of the slide, we can see that the thread is entitled WebContainer 7. So that's a well-named thread, and we'll see what a non-well-named thread looks like momentarily. And we can also see that at the bottom of the stack, we can see that it originates from COM, IBM, WS, UDL, ThreadWorker, ThreadPoolWorker.run. So that's the WebSphere application server run method. So we know that this is a thread that originated from WebSphere application server, and it has control over it. It can manage it. It determines how many there are. And it's aware of it, so it can manage it. An unmanaged thread, on the other hand, is going to have non-conventional thread names. It may just be thread 1234, or it could be even some other name that's not well named. And then they're going to originate. There's a couple of different ways they could originate. They could originate from the Java API thread.run method. So that's just the generic run method provided by the Java SDK. Or you may have your own run method that you've written, and your threads could be originating from that. In either case, they're still going to be unmanaged threads that are not under the control of WebSphere application server. We're going to jump to slide 14 to finish this topic up, I think, of the unmanaged threads. So we can encounter a number of different performance or hang issues due to unmanaged threads because we don't have control over them. We don't know how many there are. If your application, which is creating threads on its own, it creates too many threads or doesn't manage the resources of the JVM or doesn't account for the situation that you've ended up in, you could encounter performance or hang issues or possibly other issues as well. We want to reiterate that the WebSphere application server thread pool code is very robust and well exercised. And if unless you have a really compelling reason not to use unless you have a compelling reason to use unmanaged threads, you shouldn't do it. It's just not a good idea if it can be avoided at all. All right, so we will move on to slide 15. This is looking at another piece of the coding topic. This one specifically has to do with non-WebSphere application server LDAP. And this piece that we're looking at is kind of a keystone topic. There's lots of other topics that branch from it, and this is kind of a central section of the presentation. So we can see from the thread stack to the right, this is actually an unmanaged thread. We know that because of the thread name, and we also know that because of the thread.run method, which it originates from. It is not part of the WebSphere application server run methods. So we can also see, if we look at this stack a bit more, we see that after the thread.run method, we're calling into this Java API, which does some LDAP connections, and it's doing a run method out of there. This is a thread that is doing some type of LDAP activity, but it's a custom LDAP implementation. It makes use of the Java LDAP API. It's coded by the application or some third-party module and is not a part of WebSphere application server. And this is an example of, now this one thread in and of itself might not be problematic, but if you had a number of these, you could end up in a situation where you could get hung up or encounter some performance issues. We're going to move on to slide 16 to talk about this a little bit more. We want to point out that this is not related to WebSphere Application Server LDAP or WebSphere Application Server Security. Again, it's a custom LDAP implementation. This is a classic example of unmanaged threads, as we just discussed. And it's also going to link us, I mentioned it kind of being a keystone topic, it's going to link us to a topic that we're going to look at shortly, which is threads in socket read, which is a big topic under performance issues. And we can see that this thread is, in fact, doing a socket read there as well. So we see that it goes into the LDAP code, and it creates some buffer, and then it goes into the IBM JSSE code, which is just our to get SSL support for this socket, and then it's doing a socket read. And we're going to take a look at that later to see exactly what that means and what we can do from there. We're going to move on to slide 17. This is the final section of the coding topic. And this is the big one that we see probably the most in the coding topic. And this is relates to non-thread safe usage of hash maps. And to understand what we're talking about here, we need to understand what the HashMap API has to say about itself. So again, HashMap is provided as a part of the Java SDK API, and you can view it online. I've provided a link in the presentation. This is to Java 6. But the same API exists for 7 or 5 or 142. This isn't something that's changed. And the point that I want to bring out that's going to be key to this discussion is if you look at the HashMap API, the first section that you'll see in bold, it says, note that this implementation is not synchronized. So what that means is that if we're working in a multi-threaded environment, the user of the HashMap has to provide synchronization. Otherwise, you can get into a state where one thread is writing the HashMap, and another thread is trying to write a hash map. You have data integrity problems, but more often what we encounter is just some sort of hang issue or high CPU issue that encounters from two threads trying to access the same hash map at the same time. And there's other issues that can be encountered as well. This is a coding mistake, and it can be encountered anywhere. It can be made in application code that you write. It could be an application code that your third party writes. It can even be an IBM product code. In fact, there's been a number of APARs against, you know, WebSphere Application Server and other stack products where this same type of coding mistake has been made. We've corrected them, and those are listed in the APARs that we have. I only have two here on this link, but there are on this slide, but there are several that you can investigate as you want to. But it's just to point out that it's not something unique to just an application. You can have this problem that's a result of IBM product code having a defect. We'll move on to slide 18. Talk some more about the non-thread safe usage. There are some enhancements to the IBM Java 6 SDK that can mitigate the impact of improper usage. This is basically what causes this is a timing window problem where one thread is trying to access something and another thread is trying to access something, and if they both are trying to access at the same time, you can end up with a high CPU or a hang, depending on what course they were taking before they went to access the hash map. And so what this enhancement does is it tries to close that window down some more to reduce the likelihood of it happening. Now, but still, the issue can still happen. This is just, you know, enhancement that was, you know, we tried to make so that, you know, poorly written code could actually still run in most circumstances. But it is still the responsibility of the code making use of the hash map to do so in a thread-safe manner as the API dictates. The enhancements cannot protect against all improper usage of hash map. We'll move on to slide 19. We'll get to see some examples of what the threads might actually look like when you're in a situation like this. This is something you could pull from a Java core or a thread dump. But if you see that you have a number of different threads and they seem to be in, you know, it could happen on a get or a put, as we can see here. The first is a get, the second is a put. But oftentimes the method that you'll find at the top is the find non-null key entry method. And that's just where it happens to get hung up, or that's just where it happens to start to spin CPU cycles and cause your high CPU. That's just an example of what it would look like in a Java core. And the important thing to see is that in the third line down of each of these, we see hashmap.get or hashmap.put, and then immediately under that, the code that called the get or the put, we see is some code com.code.using hashmap improperly. That's the problematic code. That's the code that needs to be corrected because they're making use of the hashmap without properly synchronizing it. Move on to slide 20. And this slide, we're just showing you what we're calling a top tech note as we're looking at the top five performance topics. This is a tech note that was really born out of the authoring of this presentation, and this is a tech note that resolves a number. We see these issues on a daily basis, and this tech note takes care of most of those problems. problems, because it explains in great detail everything that we just talked about and even some more detail for certain scenarios. So it's definitely something that you might want to refer to and keep handy. Like I said, we use it every day to resolve problems that customers are reporting, and it's got a lot of good information. It's got the example thread stacks and the whole discussion of this. It also has a number of the WebSphere APARs, WebSphere Application Server APARs, which were a result of the same type of poor coding practice. So if you want to consult that list, you can see that as well. We'll move on to slide 21. So that completes the coding topic, and now we're at the infrastructure topic. We will go ahead and jump into slide 22. So the infrastructure problems that we see are situations where the performance problem, you know, looks like it's on WebSphere Application Server, but it's actually due to something that WebSphere Application Server is connected to. It could be we're connected to a database and there's something wrong with that. It could be that we're connected to an LDAP server, or even remote storage is one that we're seeing more and more as more and more customers start to use remote storage solutions, whatever you call that, NAS, SAN, NFS, whatever you want to call that. We've seen a number of performance problems arise from remote storage that just simply wasn't behaving as we would have expected. So these are some of the symptoms for infrastructure-type problems that we're going to look at here, and we're going to move on to slide 23. So more symptoms. Issues with external resources can manifest in a number of different ways. We can see hangs, slow performance, threads and socket read, which I already mentioned socket read to some extent. We're going to go into great detail on that. And then also tied to the remote storage ones, we can see I/O operations taking an extraordinary amount of time to complete, much longer than we would typically expect a simple I/O operation to take. Moving on to slide 24. Now there are there's no one-size-fits-all specific guide to resolve infrastructure-type problems like these, but we do have 3 points to consider that are applicable in every single infrastructure performance problem. These are high level enough, yet still, you know, specific enough to orient our diagnostic technique and to find the issue as quickly as possible and then resolve it. So we're going to go through these 3 points. The first is, what is the health of the external resource at the time of the issue? So, of course, before you can answer that question, you need to know what the external resource we're connecting to is. Are we talking about a database? Are we talking about an LDAP? Are we talking about a SAN? Are we talking about some other network resource that you have engaged as a part of your application? So once you know what the external resource is, you need to ask the question, what is the health of that? And that may not be something that you, the WebSphere Application Server admin, can answer. That may be something that you need to engage your database admin in, unless you have the pleasure of being both of those roles at the same time. So you may need to work, you know, with your other teams that you have at, you know, in your organization to determine, you know, the health of the different servers in your environment. The second point is then, what is the health of the connection between the application server and the external resource at the time of the issue? And this is really talking about the networking that's between them. We've seen issues where firewalls are, you know, not transferring packets. You know, they're just swallowing those and then not passing them along. We've seen IP sprayers cause problems where they're not spraying the traffic as we would have thought. We've even seen where network cards on one side or the other are the cause of the problem. So those are just things to keep in mind. I mean, you know, as your environment is distributed across a number of different servers, you need to take a look at how those servers are actually connected to one another. And that all becomes part of the diagnostic process when you're looking for infrastructure issues. And then the third point that we're looking at is, what is actually being requested or sent by the application server or the external resource at the time of the issue. Because even if your database is behaving fine, and even if your network is behaving fine, if your application just ran a query that requested the entire database, it may simply take a long time to transfer what could ultimately be gigabytes of data across the network and to the application server so that it can process it and present it. So it's important to know what your application is doing and to look at that. Again, in a similar example, it could be to LDAP servers. We see where we've requested all the users and basically the entire LDAP directory, and we want to present that all at once. So that's a situation where maybe your application could be changed to, you know, limit the number of requests, or at least that if you make a massive request that the customer or the user can expect that it's going to take some time or something like that. So it won't be perceived as a performance problem because they'll be aware of and ready for it. So again, those are the three points. Those are, you know, like I said, there's no specific this is what I do for this kind of issue, but these three points will definitely guide you know, your investigation into an infrastructure type of performance problem. On to slide 25. I'm going to take a look at some thread stacks that you might see in a Java core or a thread dump related to these type of issues. Again, this stack is actually familiar. We've already looked at it a couple times. So in this situation, we have an unmanaged thread, because we see it's thread.run, making an LDAP connection, and then it's doing a socket read. So we need to understand what socket read is, because we haven't really fully discussed that. So the socket read method is a part of the Java SDK, which we see has been called by the IBM JSSE code, which is SSL-related code, and it was called by some buffered input stream, and it's reading. So what that's going to do is it's what we call a blocking I/O call. It's going to remain in that state until it has read all of the data or the other side of the connection terminates the connection. So again, if this is an example where this LDAP code has requested the entire LDAP directory and it's just going to take a long time, it's going to stay in socket read for a long time as it reads that data. So there's anything going wrong necessarily, it's just taking a long time. It could be because you made a massive request, it could be because there's something wrong with the networking, or it could be that there's something wrong with the LDAP server itself. So that's what the socket read is. It's important to understand that it's going to stay in that state until it is done reading the data or until the other side terminates the connection. So it's the only way for it to get out of a socket read. We'll move on to slide 26, and we'll see some more socket read type stacks. In this case, we're reading from an Oracle database. As we can see from the stack, we're not reading from an LDAP server in this case. So just in the same way with the LDAP example, this could be a situation where we requested all of the records from the database. There could be something wrong with the network between the application server and the database, including, you know, network cards, cabling, firewalls, or there could be a problem with the database itself. And so we need to kind of isolate those different components down and find out where the problem is. And to answer those questions, you're going to need your application team to answer the question about what did my application just request. You're going to need to work with the networking team to find out, you know, is there something wrong with the firewalls or the cabling or the network cards? And then you may need to work with your database team to find out if there's something wrong with the database. So that's why these infrastructure issues can be tricky, especially in maybe larger organizations where there's a number of different people that you know, own each of these aspects, and so all of those people need to be engaged to work towards a resolution of the issue. Going to move on to slide 27. And these are some more examples. These ones are specific to the remote storage situations. And so what we would typically do in a performance problem is we'd get a series of Java cores, and we would look to see, you know, if a certain thread is progressing, right? Because we know that a Java core is a snapshot in time, and so we're going to use those snapshots in time to get an idea for how the JVM was progressing over time. And so if we saw in more than one Java core that Web Container 75 was still trying to delete a file, that would raise some red flags, because we don't expect a delete operation to take a long time. And by the same token, we don't expect the default for thread to take a long time to find out if a file is a directory or not. So when we see these kind of operations take a long time, those raise red flags for us, and we start asking questions like, are you using a remote storage solution, and what is the health of that solution? Again, the same kind of points go into that, the three points that we talked about. Is there something wrong with the remote storage solution? Is there something wrong with the networking between the application server and the remote storage solution? or is it possible that you've asked it to do something big? Because it is possible that maybe we're trying to delete a file and that file is massive, or maybe we're trying to create a file and that file is massive. So there are cases where maybe we could see a longer delete or a longer create, but it's not common for us to see that kind of behavior. So those three same points apply, again, whether it's socket read, and it's talking to a database or an LDAP server, or if it's trying to delete a file or determine if it's a directory and it's a remote storage solution. I'm going to move on to slide 28. Okay, and this is another top tech note. This is another tech note that was kind of born out of the authoring of the presentation. This one goes into great detail on the issues of socket read and provides the sample stacks, some of which we just looked at, and it provides the three points and sort of the diagnostic plan for issues like these. And it's just a good tech note to have to be able to refer to if you're encountering performance issues related to remote resources. Move on to slide 29. This takes us to the final section, which has got to do with planning and expectations. We'll move on to slide 30. Okay, so there's a number of different avenues beneath the planning and expectations topic. First one we're going to talk about is hardware requirements. Oftentimes we see that hardware requirements are overlooked or understated. One of the biggest things we see in that regard is not enough physical memory. Now, one of the ways that we see a lot of customers come to the determination as to how much physical memory or RAM they need to support their environment is they'll simply take their JVM heap sizes, and they'll take all their JVMs, take all their heap sizes, and they'll add those numbers up, and they'll say, that's how much RAM I need. But that overlooks a lot of things. It overlooks the fact that the operating system is obviously going to need some RAM to function. And it also overlooks the fact that the JVM process size is not simply the Java heap size. There is also a native memory component, and there is actually a significant native memory component for WebSphere application server itself. And different applications have different requirements as well. One application may use more native memory than another, just depending on what that application is doing. So if you don't have enough physical memory, you're going to encounter performance problems related to paging and swapping. And no amount of paging or swapping or using the hard disk instead of memory is going to be acceptable for any type of environment that you want to perform at any reasonable level. So it's important not to overlook the physical memory requirements of your application, and it's not a bad idea to have some extra too for growth or other things that change. As your load changes, the quantity of load might not change, but the characterization of that load might change, the complexity of that load, which may have impacts on how much physical memory is needed to facilitate that applied load. The number of JVMs kind of plays into that, again, just talking about the load as well. And planning for failover, that kind of ties in with what I was just saying as well. It's not necessarily, you don't just want to find out exactly how much you need and then draw a line in the sand and say, that's all I'm going to get. Having a little bit more for whatever is probably not a bad idea. And then we're going to move on to virtualization. This is a topic that we see a lot of planning and expectations, incorrect planning and incorrect expectations. And this, we could be talking about VMware, we could be talking about LPARs or Solaris Zones or whatever virtualization technology you want to talk about. Our economist friends remind us that there's no such thing as a free lunch, and there is no such thing as a free lunch in virtualization either. There is an overhead associated with any hypervisor, whether it's VMware, LPARs, or Solaris Zones. You simply can't take your 4-gigabyte physical machine and then break it up and say, I'm going to make two gigabyte virtual machines and everything is going to be great. It's not, because the hypervisor does have an overhead and it is going to use some of that memory. And again, it's not a bad idea just to have some more memory just for whatever you might be encountering later. So we often see not enough CPUs or not enough memory allocated to cause virtual machine problems. So that's just something to keep in mind as you're doing, as you're planning and as you're developing expectations. We'll move on to slide 31. And this is the critical takeaway point for the planning and expectations topic, and that is that effective planning and developing reasonable expectations requires testing. There's no one-size-fits-all solution to planning or expectations or tuning. You have to plan and to develop reasonable expectations. You have to test to make effective planning and develop reasonable expectations. And it has to be done for every environment. This sort of ties back actually to the first topic that we talked about, the second topic with the tuning, in that you need to plan for every environment. You can't just copy and paste your tuning from one or your expectations from one to another. Every environment needs to be tuned, every environment needs to be planned for, and every environment needs to have its own set of expectations. The last link that I've provided here on this slide is it's a presentation from our SWAT team, which is a special group within support. The presentation is actually a little bit old, but all of the points within it are still applicable. So there's a lot of stuff in there related to planning and expectations, and then even circling back again to the tuning topic that you might find useful in there. And even though it's a little bit older from a number of years ago, it's still just as meaningful and applicable to your systems today. So it's worth checking out. Move on to slide 32. Just going to provide a quick summary of what we've talked about so far, the five topics, and maybe some big takeaway points from each one. The first one is maintenance, which was an easier topic, and it's simply put, you just need to stay up to date. You can avoid issues altogether by simply having the latest maintenance levels applied. I know that keeping up with maintenance levels can be a lot of work, but encountering a performance problem in your production environment is not only a lot of work, but it can cause you a lot of headache as well. So it's worth staying up to date on your maintenance levels. The second topic, we talked about tuning, and I just want to point out here that tuning is a process. It's not a task. It's not something that you do once and then you're done with it. It's something that's ongoing and you're going to continue to do, and you're going to continue to do for all your environments. You're not just going to do it for one environment and say that, you know, I'm done. You're going to continue to do it for all of them for effective tuning. Then the third one, we talked about the coding topic. I just want to point out again the top tech note regarding hash map usage. As I mentioned, we use it every day. We encounter a PMR related to something like this, whether, you know, where some code has improperly made use of the hash map API and it's causing hang or high CPU issues. Fourth was the infrastructure topic, and again, highlighting the top tech note regarding socket read. That's another tech note that we use almost on a daily basis as we encounter issues like this. It provides the diagnostic roadmap to, you know, get through these issues. You can't just go to the tech note and know exactly what you're going to do, but it will give you the plan with which to proceed to resolve the issue as quickly as possible. And then finally, the last topic on planning and expectations. Simply put, testing is required to make a plan and to make expectations. If you don't test, you could be using old expectations or an old plan. We get PMRs open where customers telling us that we had this environment and it was able to handle so many requests, and now we've got this new environment and it's not able to handle so many requests. And where those expectations came from, the difference in the hardware, I mean, all this stuff comes into play. And so if you do your testing, you'll have a good plan and you'll have good expectations, and that's going to make things much better later on down the road. With that, we're going to move to slide 33. And this chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. You can visit the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming WebSphere Support Technical Exchange webcasts like the one you attended today, and you can access previously recorded presentations as well. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information. You can visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up the learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notifications link on all product support pages lets you sign up for a weekly email updates for products of interest to you. That, I'm going to turn it back over to David.
Okay, thank you, Travis, for a great presentation. Before we get to the question and answer session, we would like to conduct a short poll. Four questions will appear in the web conference, and your responses are greatly appreciated. The first question is, on a scale of 1 to 5, choose the number that best describes what you think about this statement. The information presented today was useful to me. Strongly agree, agree, neutral, disagree, or strongly disagree. I will pause a few seconds to collect your responses. Thank you. The second question is, on a scale of 1 to 5, choose the number that best describes what you think about this statement. The material was well organized and clearly presented. And again, I'll pause a while to collect your responses. Thank you. And the third question today, did this call meet your training expectations, yes or no? And the last question today, how did you hear about today's WSTE webcast? Thank you. We do appreciate your responses. And finally, don't forget to connect with us. You can be notified about upcoming webcasts related to the product and topics discussed today by subscribing to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange mailing list. Simply send an email to wsehelp@us.ibm.com with the subject WSTE Subscribe. Also, if there is a topic you would like to see scheduled, if you have any comments that would help us improve our future webcasts, please let us know at that same email address. You could also connect with us through our Facebook page and our Twitter account. Talk to us and let us know how we can make this program better for you. Thanks again for your participation. Moving on to the Q&A session, I would like to remind you that for those of you who join us via the web conference, you can also post your questions in the group chat. Precedence will be given to questions asked through the phone, and if time permits, we will also address questions in the group chat. At this time, Tanya, we would like to open the lines for questions.
Thank you. At this time, we are ready for the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. To withdraw your question, press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment. Our first question, William Graham, your line is open. Please unmute your line. William.
I'm unmuted. I was just wondering if there's a quick down and dirty way to spot a hung thread just by looking at your system out logs.
Yeah, so that's a good question. There are one of the functionalities provided in WebSphere Application Server is what we call a thread monitor. And the thread monitor does time-based analysis on what certain threads are doing, And so if there's a thread that's been, the default timeout parameter for that is 10 minutes, so it is configurable. So if you've had a thread that's executing the same task for over 10 minutes, there'll be a message printed out to the system out that log that says, this thread is thought to be hung, you know, and it's executing this stack. In the latest versions of WebSphere Application Server, it will say the stack that it's actually executing. In older versions, it won't. The way that we search for those is we just search our systemout.log for the word hung, H-U-N-G, and you'll find the occurrences of that. I do want to mention that there's also, while there's the message that says, you know, I think that this thread is hung, again, it's really just time-based analysis. It doesn't have any idea what else is going on inside the JVM. There could be a legitimate reason for that thread to be taking 10 minutes. So if there's a situation where a thread that was thought to be hung has later on progressed and now moved on to something else, it will also print a message that says, you know, I previously thought that this thread was hung, but it's actually moved on. So just to let you know that, you know, a thread that they thought was hung is actually not hung. So that's the way that we check for them from our system out.log. And then, you know, in some cases that's enough. Just if you have the thread stack information from the later versions of WebSphere Application Server, but in other situations, you may need to get a series of Java cores at the same time. You can get those manually, and actually there's also a way to configure the thread monitor now, again in later versions of WebSphere Application Server, to automatically generate Java cores on the occurrence of a hung thread warning message. So those are some different things related to the thread monitor and hung threads in the system out.
Okay, thank you.
No problem.
Our next question, Victor Shan, your line is open.
I know there's some performance tuning tools like the embedded TVD performance viewer and also ITCAM, those kind of tools, and maybe even garbage collections. Do you have any preference or strong recommendation for certain ones?
Yeah. Yeah, so you can use any of those number of tools, whether it's the Tivoli Performance Viewer or some other tool that you may have. Java Health Center is another way to monitor your JVM's performance and maybe get some tuning recommendations out of it. There's other tools that analyze garbage collection verbose GC output. So after the run of a JVM, you can evaluate what the health of the garbage collector was. all those tools are valid, and all of those tools actually work on data that's already generated. In most cases, specifically the GC ones, that data exists in its raw format as well. You can just look at the raw data if you know what's in there, or you can use a tool that will break that down. Any of the ones that I've mentioned are good ways to do that. GCMV is what we call it. I think the full name is Garbage Collection Modeling Viewer. You might need to Google that to find the proper name for it, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. And that's a good tool for garbage collection and tuning that, and that'll help you tune your heap size, tune your garbage collection policy, things related to that. The Tivoli Performance Viewer within the admin console, I don't know that I would use that much for tuning as much as just, you know, real-time monitoring to make sure things are okay. You may be able to glean, you know, something from it that might inform some decision that you make with regard to tuning. But in general, I would just use that for real-time monitoring probably.
Okay, great. Thanks. But just if I may, one more follow-up question about this person before I just asked the Hans Red thing. Is that because I saw those messages before, but it sounds like it seems to me only the web containers thread I saw those warnings. Is that for all the thread? Actually, I believe it's all the managed thread, I would say.
That is exactly right, and that's a good distinction. That ties into the presentation well. The thread monitor can only monitor managed threads. It cannot monitor unmanaged threads, and so that's another reason why using managed threads would be a benefit. So, you know, your web container threads, your default threads, your TCP TCS threads, any thread pools that exist within the WebSphere application server environment are going to be able to be monitored by the thread monitor.
And it's on by default.
Yes, it is on by default, and the default time is 10 minutes, and that is configurable as well. And again, with a thread monitor, one of the things you can change on it, if it's not on by default, is you can have it generate Java cores automatically on the occurrence of a hung thread warning message.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Our next question, Peter Hudkovic. Your line is open.
Hello. I just want to ask, what should be the right procedure if a customer wants to stay with the version he has, like, for example, WebSphere 7.0.0.7, and because for some reason it's not compatible or he's experiencing some trouble with the older products?
Yeah, so we do encounter situations where, and this was one of the topics related to maintenance, where, you know, for whatever reason, the customer can't move off of what we would consider to be an older version, an older maintenance level of the product. Sometimes there's legitimate compatibility issues with a particular vendor's application, and, you know, that's really a problem of the vendor, that they're not keeping up with the product. In situations where, unfortunately, the reality of that is if you can't upgrade, you can't upgrade, which means that you're susceptible to all the defects that are found and then later corrected. It is possible in certain situations that after you encounter an issue and after you go through the process of rediscovering that issue, you might be able to get some sort of iFix or one-off kind of situation where you might be able to get a fix for just that one thing. But that takes a significant business justification and is pretty rare, especially on really old versions like 7.0.7. It would be really unlikely to be able to get something like that. But I guess I would just encourage the customer that encounters that issue, if they really do have a legitimate compatibility problem with some other with their application vendor, they really need to probably lean on their application vendor to see if they can get that updated to work so that they can take advantage of all the fixes that have been put into the product since their current version.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question, Eric Kendall, your line is open.
Yeah, hi. Quick question on the Java heap. I mean, how much are you encountering, because we typically set the mins and the max, other parameters like nursery size, for example, setting of the Eden space. Do you see that as being very important? Do you run into a lot of issues regarding that?
Yeah, we can definitely run into performance issues related to garbage collection and heat tuning, which are kind of one and the same. It's hard. There's no hard and fast rules for every environment because every application is different and every environment in which it's running is different. If we're going to toss out maybe some guidelines on some of the things that you mentioned, if you're setting your min equal to max, that's what we refer to as a fixed heap size. And in the later versions of the SDK, Java 5, Java 6, Java 7, we don't view that as particularly problematic. You may have encountered someone before when talking about an older version of Java where they might not recommend that. In fact, you'll see on the performance team link that was in the presentation, they talk about setting your heap to a fixed size as being a way to improve performance, and it comes at a cost of memory, I suppose. But if your goal is strictly performance, then that's probably the thing to do. With regard to your nursery size, we typically offer, our suggestion is somewhere in the order. Again, there's no hard and fast rules, but somewhere around 30% of your total heap size that might be an appropriate size for your nursery. And if you have a variable heap size, you need to have a variable nursery size as well so that can keep up with that. You don't want to have them at one point on the low end be, your nursery is 50% of your heap, and then at the high end it's, something much lower than that. So you want to keep those proportional to one another. In general, what we're going to see for heap sizes for application servers, for a 32-bit JVM, the most we're going to see is 1536 megabytes or 1.5 gigabytes. That's our maximum recommended value for the maximum heap size for a 32-bit JVM. And that, again, has to do with native memory considerations, which we talked about briefly in the presentation. But we can see that go down to 1024 as well. So somewhere in between the area of 1 gig and 1.5 gig is what we would typically expect for 32-bit JVM. The one thing I will say now while we're on the topic is relates to 64-bit JVMs and heap sizing. When we get PMRs where customers are running 64-bit JVMs and they're running with a heap size that's 1 gig or 1.5 gigs or even something less than that, it really makes us start to wonder why the customer made a decision to do that. They made the decision to go to 64-bit JVMs, yet they're not taking advantage of any of the benefits of it, but they're still incurring all the overhead that's involved with that. When you move to a 64-bit JVM, there's a greater cost of doing business. The memory references are all larger. All the objects are larger just by nature of the address space. So the same application running on a 32-bit JVM is going to use one amount of memory, but the same application on the 64-bit environment is going to use more memory because of the increased size of memory references and whatnot. So that's important to keep in mind, that your 64-bit JVMs in general, you're going to see us recommend, at least 2 gigabytes. If you're not greater than 2 gigabytes, it kind of doesn't make sense to us why you decide to go to a 64-bit JVM.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our next question, Nathan Bost. Your line is open.
Hey, Travis.
Hey.
Hey, Travis. Thanks for the talk. Is there any significance when you're looking at a hang issue with LDAP and socket read to seeing a really high index unmanaged thread?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The thread indexes on unmanaged threads are not necessarily viewed to be problematic. They could be, but we don't know for sure, actually. And that's the problem with an unmanaged thread. There's just a lot that we don't know. In a managed thread environment, you may have encountered, documentation that talks about high thread indexes. And so for everyone else's benefit, we're talking about, Web Container 7 has an index of 7, but Web Container 4000 has an index of 4000, and that's a high number, 4000. So you'll see us in a managed thread pool situation, we want to keep those numbers low if we can, just based on what we know about the way our thread pool works. But we don't know how the other threads work, and that's because they're unmanaged. So it could be problematic, or it might not be problematic. It's hard to say. It's just you can't really answer that, unfortunately, because we just don't know that much about where the thread is originated from and how it works and what the internals of it are.
Our next question, Dale Weber, your line is open.
Hi, Travis. quick question for you. One thing about encoding practices that we run into occasionally here has to do with finalizer, mm-hmm. the finalizer thread or finalizer
yep.
methods, where people have coded things that hit the finalizer and basically go into a wait forever,
mm-hmm.
waiting for something other resource to do. Is that something you guys run into once in a while, and maybe it should be a coding practice?
Yeah,
change?
It is something that I would say we used to run into more frequently than we do now. I think we've gotten the message out to a lot of customers that using finalizers is discouraged, and the reason for that is because finalization is never guaranteed as a part of the Java SDK. That's kind of one of those API things that comes to get you, just like with the hash maps. They're not synchronized, you know, in the design, and finalizers are not guaranteed to run under any condition. They might run, and they might run at some point, but they're not guaranteed to run. And so when you use finalizers, you can end up with a situation where you have all these objects filling up your heap that are really eligible to be garbage collected, but you've made use of the finalize method, and therefore the objects are all just sitting around cluttering up the heap. So the use of finalizers, the finalize method, is discouraged and should be part of a coding practice not to use them.
Okay, I just wondered if you wanted to add that to your...
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, and of course, you know, there's a... You know, we could have done top 10, top 15, top 100 almost.
Sure,
but,
yeah, I know.
You know. So those are just the ones that we picked out. But that is a very good one. And I think probably the only reason it really didn't make even the top five in this case is it probably would have a couple years ago, but it's just changed some over time such that we don't see that so much.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question... Brent Morris, your line is open.
Yes, thank you, first of all, for putting this presentation together. I was wondering, are you finding ephemeral port exhaustion as still being an issue, even though it didn't make your top five?
No, we don't see too much of that at all, really. I suppose we do see that every now and then, but it's not really a big one that we see very often from many customers. And I don't even really know much about that one, to be honest.
Okay. I mean, we see it where we have basically sloppy coding,
right,
where folks are making a tremendous amount of connections. They're not going back in, cleaning anything up.
Yeah.
And we end up hitting that ceiling of 5,000 ports, even though there's over 60,000 ports available. So...
I think the way that might, and maybe the reason why I'm not so familiar with that, again, I'm dealing particularly with the performance-related issues. That's one where you may get some other type of error message, you know, whether it's from the connection pool or from your application code, and it just simply doesn't get routed through our queue and through our team. But that could be an issue that maybe some of the other teams, we do have a team that specializes in connection pools and connection-type issues. And that could be maybe where that's going and why that's not something I see so much.
All righty. Well, thank you for your answer.
We do have several questions in the group chat, and I'll start the first one that I saw. And the question is, it seems to be related to a message. The return of alarm thread non-deferrable alarm has been delayed for 16,094 milliseconds. This may be preventing normal alarm function within the application server. What does this mean?
Yeah, I can talk about that a little bit. I think this message, I'm pretty sure, is from some of the very latest versions of Webster Application Server 8 and 8.5. And this message is actually very similar to the hung thread warning messages, except for the fact that it's for the alarm thread pool. So this basically, and it's also similar to CPU starvation messages, which you may have heard of or encountered before. But for whatever reason, this alarm thread didn't get a chance to go back to the pool for 16 seconds, which is probably a long time. The important thing to understand and know would be to see what that thread was doing at that time. Now, I'm not sure if in addition to this error message, there may have also been a thread stack associated with it. You know, it said, you know, deferrable alarm 2, you know, was in the state. You know, at the time of this error message, it would be important to look at what that thread was doing at that point in time, and maybe even, you know, what it did after that. So I can't really answer. I mean, it just depends on what that thread was doing at the time. But it's very similar to the hung thread warning message.
Okay, thank you. And then the next question I see is having to do with a servlet web app error report message, 199E.
Yeah, I see it there.
Output stream already obtained.
Yeah, this it's not an error message that I'm familiar with. We don't typically see it from a performance point of view. It looks to me that there's something wrong with it's coming from the web container, and there's something to do with the stream that it's writing out on. I really can't comment much on that, but I'd encourage you that if you have a number of those, I would just open up a PMR simply with that text, and that would get us routed to the appropriate team to figure out what's going on.
Okay, thank you. And then the next question, what is the minimum heap requirements of the WebSphere application server itself?
Yeah, the default heap requirements, which I would say are probably also the minimum heap requirements, would be the 50 megabytes for the initial heap size and then 256 for the maximum heap size. Now, those aren't really going to be effective heap sizes in a production environment, but I certainly wouldn't go any lower than that. In general, again, for a 32-bit environment, we're talking about 1024 megabytes to 1.5 gigabytes for an application server. And on 64-bit, that could be even, you know, we would want to see something greater to actually realize the benefits of the 64-bit environment.
Okay, thank you. And then how many JVMs can we have on a node? Is there any limitation?
There's no limitation from a JVM point of view. It's really got to do with the resources that you have available. I do kind of see maybe where this is going in the chat here, talking about core groups and things like that. There may be some limitation imposed by the core group infrastructure. I don't know all of that inside out and backwards. So it might be a question that, you could pose to a PMR if you're encountering some limitation with that. But there's no limitation from a Java SDK point of view. I mean, it's really just got to do with how many operating system resources do you have in your environment.
Okay, thank you. And then there's a couple questions from the same person having to do with tuning. How much time or any specific time needed for warming up JVM for any parameters?
Yeah, so it wouldn't necessarily be time-based necessarily, but it would be based on the number of requests and the number of executions that you've gone through. It's hard to put a time on it. I could say that an hour probably isn't enough. You know, 5 hours you might be getting warmed up if we're going to put time requirements on it. Again, these are all just, you know, gauging on maybe a typical load test. But an hour isn't long enough. I guess that's maybe what we see a lot is we'll see customers, they start their JVM, they run their test, they get their results, and then they restart the JVM and the test is complete. But you only ran the test once and you ran it before the JVM was really warmed up, and in that situation, you're probably not getting the right, the right result, the true results for how your JVM is going to perform on the long haul. If you're testing to run your JVM for a week and for a month, or if your plan is to go for your JVM to go for a week or a month or 2 months or a quarter, then you should test the same. There's no substitute for the same testing that you plan to actually perform with.
Okay. And then related to that, would the number of JVMs expect to have an issue on impact on the tuning?
Yeah. Again, I think that just kind of relates to the physical resources that you have. The number of JVMs is only limited from, you know, an operating system and from a process point of view with the resources that you have to back that. And so if you have 100 JVMs, then, yeah, your tuning is going to be affected because now you have 100 JVMs and they all need to have sufficient, you know, physical memory to have, you know, adequate performance and CPUs. And all of that needs to be of sufficient value.
Okay, thank you. And then I think this has been touched on already, but someone was asking about any restriction or recommendation about the maximum size of the Java heap Is it possible to assign 4 gigabyte or 8 gigabyte as a maximum Java heap size? I would prefer to scale vertically the server instead of assigning more memory to a single application server.
Yeah, let's see. So the for a 32-bit JVM, yes, there is a maximum, and the maximum recommended value for your maximum heap size is 1.5 gigabytes, and that has to do with our understanding of the way that the operating system is also going to use some of the address space, and then how much native memory we need to have available for most applications. In some situations, your maximum heap size needs to be even less than 1.5 gigabytes if you have a native memory-intensive application, because you need to reduce your heap size to increase your native size. As far as 64-bit, you know, the sky's the limit. I mean, as much RAM as you have, the JVM is going to be able to support. There are costs of having a massive heap like that. If you're talking about 4 gigabytes, 8 gigabytes, garbage collections are now going to take a long time to go because now they have to go over a whole 8 gigabyte section. But maybe you don't have to do them as often because your heap is that large. I think that answers the question.
Okay, thank you. And then another question about troubleshooting an memory out of memory problem. Is it possible to figure out which application gave the out of memory error? Because usually what you get is just a class name or application object, but that same class or object could be used by in many different applications. How can you track down which application is the faulty one?
Yes, that's a very good question, and unfortunately the answer is no. There's no way to tell which application caused the problem unless you can isolate those applications by only running one of the applications in the particular environment. If they all use common objects, it is possible in an out-of-memory situation that you could, with a processed system core, so this isn't a heap dump, this is a processed system core, you can actually see the contents of the object, and if your developers can see the contents of the object and then, figure out which application it's from, that's something that they could be able to do. But outside of that, unless you can isolate the application, there's no way to determine which of the applications in the application server is responsible for the out-of-memory.
Okay, thank you. And then a question, where is the thread monitor configured?
Yeah, it's a custom property that you can set. I don't know where it is off the top of my head, but if you Googled for WebSphere Application Server Thread Monitor, you should be able to find something in the information center that will have the property along with other properties. I mean, the same place, the same information center article will have information on how to change the timeout value. Right, the default is 10 minutes, and then it has the option to enable the Java core on hung thread warning message. I think you should be able to find that pretty quickly on Google, I think.
Okay, thanks. Next question, what is the version of WAS that allows the dump trigger to be configured?
Yeah, so that's the same kind of thing. I don't know exactly which version it is, but I do know that you can do it at some maintenance level, some fixed pack level that became available. And in that Information Center article, it will detail which versions are have that capability. It's at some point in 7 and then at every maintenance level after that, and therefore Application Server 8 and 8.5. I don't believe you can do it in 6.1. If you can, it's in some of the very latest maintenance levels.
All right, thank you. Let's see, then there's a question. From your experience addressing performance issues in WebSphere environments, have you ever known about performance issues with geographically distributed cells? And by that I mean having a cluster spread across multiple data centers with really long distances between them. What considerations, besides a really fast and reliable network, should such an implementation have to avoid performance issues, or don't you recommend that approach at all?
Well, that's an approach that we see, but you're definitely susceptible to a lot of infrastructure problems there. I mean, if you're spanning data centers that, and ultimately if they're data centers that span the Internet, you're going to have to deal with all the that's in between there, right? Obviously, you're going to have a hard time diagnosing all of the Internet nodes in between your two data center points. you know, to find if there's any networking problems there. It's just you're opening yourself up to a lot of potential problems when you use a design like that. It's not to say that you can't do it. It's not to say that it's not being done, but you just have to be mindful of what it is that you're doing.
Okay, thank you. And then there's a question, I'm not completely sure, from Nayasi, about garbage collection, too many socket open errors. Can you shed some light on that?
I think
you said it doesn't happen often, but...
Yeah, so let's see here. There might be a couple of things going on here. The too many socket open errors, I'm not sure if that's too many sockets open or too many files. That's the kind of error that we see sometimes. It's not really related to garbage collection, though, so I'm not really sure how to answer this question.
He just responded, too many files.
Okay, yeah, too many files. Okay, yeah, so that's
okay.
What I thought it might be. Too many files isn't related to garbage collection. It's related to the number of file handles that are permitted by the operating system for a particular process to have. It, depending on what OS you're using, this is controlled by the ulimit-n parameter. So that's the number of open files. And sockets actually do, and that's why I thought you might be talking about this, sockets are wrapped up in this as well. So any socket actually has a file handle as well. If your ulimit-n setting is too small, you can run into situations where you might get too many open files error messages. And the solution to that is to first increase your ulimit-n setting. Our recommendation is to set it to at least 8,000 or 8192 if you want to be a power of 2. And that's usually sufficient to support WebSphere application server. Anything less than that, the first thing we're going to do is ask you to increase it to a reasonable size. Now, if you're still getting those messages after you increase it to a reasonable size, greater than 8,000, what you might be looking at there is some sort of file descriptor. That's what we call it, a file descriptor leak. And that's an issue that definitely requires a PMR and investigation.
Okay, thanks. And then related to garbage collection again, are there disadvantages of having larger heap sizes greater than 4 gigabyte, even in 64-bit, because of garbage collection overhead?
Yep. If 4 gigabytes, I don't think you're going to hit any problems, but if you start to get into the 8 gigabytes realm, or even, I mean, you've seen customers, you know, 24 gigabytes or, you know, 50 gigabytes of heap size, the garbage collection is going to be expensive. Now, it does depend on what garbage collection policy you're using, because each one's going to have different performance. There are, in the latest version of the product, a number of different new GC policies, some that specifically target working with large heaps like this. So I guess I just encourage you to take a look at, you know, some of the latest GC policies which specifically target using large heap sizes, because their performance is going to be much better than some of the legacy or some of the older garbage collection policies that were really designed for 32-bit environments.
Okay, thank you. And then another question. How can an application have a memory leak when using Gen Con policy and not when using the default for v6.1 opt throughput?
Well, I would say that it probably can't. There's probably something else going on there. If we've come to the conclusion that there is a memory leak with one GC policy and not with another, we may have arrived at the wrong conclusion. There's probably something that needs to be looked at again there. That shouldn't be the case.
Okay, thanks. And we're getting, near the end. How to check the number of hits for an application on the WAS side?
I don't know too much about that. I know that there's, even maybe the Tivoli Performance Viewer, which we mentioned before, might keep some stuff on that. I know that there's some other utilities built into WebSphere Application Server, one called Request Metrics that might be able to help with that. I don't know too much about that, how to monitor how many hits, you know, just on the WebSphere Application Server side. But you might be able to come up with an answer with by Googling for something like that, maybe look for the request metrics or even the performance viewer. That might help guide your search on that further.
Okay. And then, is there an easy way to understand thread dump output? Is there a utility we could use?
Yeah, so the thread dump output or the Java core output is text-based, so you can look at it in a text editor. It does take some getting used to and some understanding what you're looking at there. There are some, you can find some stuff on the internet that might be able to help explain that. We do have some tools that will digest the text output and turn it into some sort of graphical output. One of those is called the Thread Dump and Monitor Analyzer. It's available on DeveloperWorks. That's a tool that that some people use to get a graphical output of the same text data, and that's probably the one that I would recommend if you're going to look for something like that.
All right, thank you. And then the last question as of right now, are CPU starvation messages related to memory issues? If so, why is it identified as CPU issue, and what should I check to avoid those messages? How bad are these messages for the environment?
Okay, that's a good question well stated. The CPU starvation message is really probably mislabeled. There is a tech note, and I'll try to put it in the chat here when I'm all done here, because this is an important one. It's surprising that this one actually didn't make it into the presentation. There's three things that can cause CPU starvation warning messages, and they are paging. So you've overcommitted your physical memory resources, and now it's paging. Too many threads, so you've got 500 threads on your 32-bit JVM, and that's just too many because the context switching ends up overwhelming the environment. And then the third one is garbage collection activity. In most cases, it's garbage collection activity that's causing the problem. So you're right to point out, and in fact, when we have CPU starvation, it's not likely to see high CPU. It's important to understand that CPU starvation does not equal high CPU. In fact, in most cases, it does not equal high CPU. That's the start of that. They can be bad, but it's important to, in this tech note that I'm going to put into the chat here at the conclusion of this, talks about this. It depends on how long the messages are for, right? It'll say like CPU starvation for 5 seconds or CPU starvation for 200 seconds, and then what the frequency of those messages are. If you're getting the threshold that we publish on the internet is 20 seconds. If your messages are under 20 seconds and relatively far apart, you can probably just ignore the messages, and it's probably you're not going to have any trouble. The real thing, the real test for this though is, are you encountering any other tangible issue? Is there actually anything else that you can feel from these at the same time of these messages, or are you just concerned about the presence of the message? If you're just concerned about the presence of the message, you likely don't have a problem. But you might want to check the frequency and the duration of those messages, and that's all detailed in the tech note that I'm going to link in there. And it is configurable as well. So, for example, if you just have an environment that always gets CPU starvation warning messages for 5 seconds and there's no real problem, then you can turn the threshold up, such that you won't get those messages anymore. And I'll paste that into the chat just as we finish up here.
All right. Thanks, Travis. I don't believe I see any more questions, and we are reaching the hour and a half mark. I will leave the web conference up for a few minutes if you want to post some tech note out there, Travis.
Okay.
So at this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable. We appreciate your participation and hope you'll join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Travis, for presenting today.
Thank you.